Mike Wilson, how may I help you today?
Hello, this is the Microsoft Fraud Detection Department. By answering this call, you have helped us find your exact location. Thank you for your contribution. Authorities are on their way. To cancel this action, please press 1. Thank you. To speak with a live representative, please press 2.
Thank you for calling Microsoft Fraud Department. This is Amanda. How can I help you?
Welcome back, everybody. This is episode 7 of The Lockdown, recorded on January the 27th, 2024. Yet again, I went AWOL. Don't worry, I've just been travelling for business. I was not kidnapped for a second time, but I have a fully packed show for you today. I have some updates for you. The website is now live, lockdown.media. And this is where I'm going to share some of the more in-depth and more technical articles, which would really be out of scope for the podcast episodes. One of the things I'm working on at the moment is a complete guide to setting up pfSense on a Quotum mini PC. I'll talk more about that in today's show. Now, I already run this in my home network. It has an always-on VPN, VLANs for different Wi-Fi SSIDs, so you can isolate your network if you have to have IoT devices. Perhaps you have a robot vacuum cleaner. You can stick that on a completely isolated network with VPN and no one needs to know who you are, and it has no way of scanning the rest of the devices in your network. So in today's show, I'm going to be talking about hotels and privacy when on the road. We'll also talk about using an alias name when checking into hotels versus the alternative, which is to use VRBO, short-term holiday rentals. We'll discuss privacy or the lack of with Uber, and also a reminder again of why we do this in the first place. I'd like to introduce another topic in today's show called Defensive OSINT, and I'll share some tips and tricks, including FaceMorph, which is a website to take your real photo and using AI, just changing it ever so slightly if you need photo ID for a gym or a library. We'll talk about location tracking and why I allow access to a weather app on my Graphene OS device, and we may even have a surprise guest at the very end of the show. Anyway, on with today's podcast. So I thought I'd start the show talking about travel, privacy, especially when it comes down to hotels. I've had situations in the past where I've stayed in a hotel and I had a phone call at 1 o'clock in the morning. The next day I had an exam. This was way back, I think it was in the late 90s, and it was my final exam for the MCSE, which dates me a little bit there. But anyway, the phone rang at 1 a.m, there was heavy breathing, and I got just very frustrated and unplugged the phone. Ever since, every time I check into a hotel room, I unplug the phone. I don't want people bothering me, especially not at 1 o'clock in the morning. But more recently, in fact, a recent trip to Vegas, I noticed there was an iPad on display in the room. It was on some sort of dock, so it was always on charge. And it had a welcome note on there, room temperature controls, that kind of thing. But the iPad has a front-facing camera and also a rear-facing camera. And there's no way I can tell if the application they're using on there has the ability to give perhaps their housekeepers access to the camera. Even if it doesn't give them access, there are undoubtedly vulnerabilities that are yet to be discovered in the app, and I just do not want to be part of it. So again, I unplug the iPad, I turn it off, and I stick it in a drawer. But the problem still comes in a hotel where you may not want to give them your real name, and this is where I have had a lot of trouble. If I book online, I can book it in an alias name, and I can pay with a privacy.com virtual card. But when you check into the hotel, they're going to ask you for photo ID and a credit card to keep on file. And the photo ID, more often than not, does have to be government-issued ID, such as a driving license or a passport. Now, if you've booked in an alias name, you're now screwed. You're going to have to spend the night in the hotel lobby. The credit card is not too much of an issue. In fact, what I have done in the past is said I've lost my card or been issued a new card. I don't have the physical card with me, but hey, my banking app has this virtual card feature. I can give you the card number. And actually, I've shown them the privacy app generated a card. And you've got to remember, these are not privacy and security experts. So they just look at the app and they type the card number and I'm good to go. But the problem is the ID. Now, unless you have fake ID, and by the way, I am not advocating that, you're going to get yourself arrested. They're not going to accept anything else. I've tried gym membership, employee cards. None of that is going to cut it. What you may have some success with, if you've already told them the story of the credit card being missing, is to say you've lost your wallet. I do have the advantage of having a British accent. Say, look, I don't have any other ID other than my passport. And one of the excuses I have used in the past is to say, look, I work in the technology industry and the data center is a very secure location and they take my passport for the week while they give me my employee ID badge. And I can show them that I have an employee ID badge. It doesn't have my name on it. It just has my picture. And sometimes that is enough to get me checked into the hotel room. But sometimes it causes a problem. Now, because I travel for business and I have an employer, I have to check into the hotel under my real name. I don't like it, but unless I'm willing to pay for the hotel myself and take those risks, it's something I have to do. But this is where you can still take some good privacy measures when checking into hotels. First, I use my credit card, which is registered to a private mailbox. It does not have any association with my real home address. Secondly, the government ID I give them when checking into the hotel doesn't have my address on there. I do not ever give them a driving license because that has an address. And that's not going to match the billing address, which is a private mailbox. So I give them a government photo ID card. This could be a visa, a passport, or something along those lines. But it's enough to prove your name, date of birth, and your photo, and they can prove it's you. It never arouses suspicion. And hotels have become much more stringent now on security. There's been incidents in the past. It's just got worse and worse, and they don't want trouble. And their staff have been trained not to accept strange-looking ID or elusive payment methods. So what I tend to do, especially when traveling on business, is just use my real name. But when I do need to use an alias name, I don't check in to the Hilton or the Marriott or any of those hotels. I check in to VRBO, short-term holiday rentals. There's usually a minimum of a three-night stay, but I've never been asked for my ID. Now, I've just been reading the Airbnb hosts subreddit, and honestly, it's quite horrifying. First off, there's people in there saying, put in your rules that government ID is required. Ask them to email it. And people are emailing their government ID with a picture of them holding the ID up to prove who they are, is who they say they are. There is no way I am emailing any ID to anybody, and nobody should. There's no legitimate reason to be using email to send ID. That's just going to end up sitting in someone's Gmail account. That will end up getting compromised because they use the same password for everything. And then your ID gets taken. Yeah, Airbnb, I've never ever used it in my life, so I don't know what their requirements are. But VRBO is another US-based short-term holiday let site, similar to Airbnb from what I understand. But I've never had issues. I use a privacy.com card. I use an alias name. Nobody has my real address and they have a pseudo phone number. I've been using that method for years. Now, maybe my account has been aged and matured, so I'm now a trusted traveler. I don't know how the system works on the back end, but I've never had a single issue. But it does make me laugh when I do check into these properties, and we do like to go as a family to the mountains. And when we rent a log cabin, we go in and the kids turn the TV on and they start watching Netflix using someone else's account. So many people will use the Wi-Fi, log into Netflix on the TVs and just leave it logged in. Now back to the hotel, just to recap, as soon as I check in, I disconnect the alarm clock, I put it in the drawer. I unplug the phone and look for any other devices that I can unplug and hide away in case they have cameras or microphones. In fact, they all do have cameras and microphones. The iPad did in the Vegas hotel. There was an alarm clock in another hotel last week that had a wireless charging station and it had Wi-Fi and all sorts of other things going on. So yet again, there's a microphone in there. So unplug all those things. Now, just to close out the topic of hotels, if you're feeling vulnerable, traveling alone, perhaps your wife is traveling alone, wife and kids, anyone at all, I would highly recommend the Black Portable Hotel Door Lock. You can buy them on Amazon. They're under $10. They're slightly bulky. It looks like a bolt, but it slides in between the door and the door jamb. And you've got a thumb screw that you can tighten, and it makes it very difficult to open that door from the other side. So if you're traveling alone, I highly recommend getting one of these. You don't need tools to install it. You can install it very quickly. It's fairly flat when you put it in your bag. It shouldn't add too much weight to the bag, but it's highly recommended. In fact, I was once in Bali in Indonesia, and I was on a business trip. It was a very nice hotel, so I was not complaining being there at all. I returned to my room at the end of the day, and I noticed that the chain lock on the inside that slides across no longer reached. I thought, well, that's strange. The past two nights I've been putting that latch on, but it didn't reach. And I had a look, and you could see the screw holes above where they had moved it down out of reach. Now that is very suspicious. It was probably a maintenance or housekeeping person that was planning to return to the room during the night to either do something bad to me or take my things. I used a knife that was in the hotel kitchen area to just move the lock back up and tighten the screws back in. But if you have one of these portable door locks, which you can buy on Amazon for less than $10, then that solves the problem. No one is getting through that door. And if you want to get one, I'll make sure to put a link in the show notes. I'm not affiliated with them. I don't get any kickback. It's just something I would strongly recommend. Okay, so while on the subject of privacy tips while on the road, I was actually chatting to a listener, and it just coincided with my travel over the past few weeks, and he was talking about Uber. Now, Uber is a problem, and so is Lyft. I'll talk about that in a moment. Let's just focus on Uber. Recently, I created a new account. I gave them a my pseudo virtual phone number, but I did give them a real credit card. But that's registered to a private mailbox address. Uber will not accept a privacy.com virtual card. It just simply won't work. They won't accept Visa gift cards, so you really don't have much of a choice other than to use a real credit card. Now, the listener I was chatting to said he'd even tried Uber gift cards, and they do work, but it asks you to put another credit card on file. So they're not holding back here. They really want to find out who you are. So picture the scene. I'm in Vegas, and I'm about to get an Uber ride back to the hotel. And it said, sorry, you need to give us another phone number. It didn't like the fact I was using a pseudo virtual phone number. Even though it had sent a code there and it accepted the validation code, no problem, it was trying to get me to give them my real SIM number, which I wasn't doing. Now, interestingly enough, I switched to the business profile. The business profile is linked to the company I work for, but they only have the pseudo virtual phone number and the same credit card, and it worked. So I think when an Uber account is associated with a company that you may work for, the restrictions are less invasive. It accepts the pseudo number. So far, it hasn't stopped me, but when I switch back to my personal profile within the Uber app, even though they're the same details, it's prompting me again for the real phone number. Now, I gave up on Lyft many years ago now. They just kept blocking the account and leaving me stranded. Uber, I do have more success with, but I never, and I highly recommend that you never get Uber to pick you up from your home or take you back to your home. Now, I know it's not entirely practical walking half a mile up the road to a gas station, but that's what I do. If I need to go to an airport, I drive. So what else does Uber know about me? Well, not a lot. They know my first name and the first letter of my last name. There's no photo, and they have the email address for my company. Now, this is the downside. To link it to a company account, you have to give them your work email. Now, if you can convince your company to give you an extra email address as an alias, which is highly unlikely, especially if you work for a large organization, then that would be perfect, because what they're doing, they're matching the domain name. So if you work for Microsoft, they're just matching an @microsoft.com email address. Now, if you have any other privacy tips for Uber or even Lyft, let me know. I'd love to hear if there's other techniques that I have not considered. Okay, I think it's time that we give ourselves another reminder of why we do this in the first place. Now, when I'm asked why I do this and I have a 30-second elevator pitch, I try and keep it simple. Protecting your privacy isn't about having something to hide. It's about what we have to protect from identity theft, fraud, social engineering, stalkers, ransomware, the list goes on. I always say that you never know how your situation may change overnight. Perhaps you win the lottery, or perhaps something more sinister happens in your life. When you are suddenly thrust into the spotlight, it happens unexpectedly, and you have the media knocking at your door. Now, on the practical side, you must think, if you have a family, you may have a wife and kids. Even if you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, later today. Now, I have kids. One of them's at high school. No secret there. But what if a boy in that school develops an unhealthy obsession with my daughter? I don't want that individual being able to go onto Google and find where my daughter lives, where we sleep at night. Perhaps I'm in a restaurant and make a complaint because they burn the pizza. By the way, that happened to me at Christmas. I didn't complain. I'm quite easygoing. But let's say I complained. They've burnt the pizza and the server gets fired. Well, if he's got my name for my credit card, again, I don't want that person retaliating against me. If you look on twitch.tv, Google the news for that. There's been swatting attempts. People have been shot and murdered through swatting attacks. And by the way, a swatting attack is when someone doxes you, finds out your information, open source intelligence, and I'll talk more about that later in this show. And they call the police and they'll pretend to be someone in the house saying that there's someone with a gun, someone's been killed, you're hiding in a room somewhere. The police take this very seriously. And the next thing you know, the SWAT team turns up with guns and it's a highly tense and fraught situation and people have died. On the less sinister examples, people have had catapults with rocks fired at their house. You never know what gripe or malice someone may hold against you for the most simple of things. And let's be frank here. If I was still living in the United Kingdom, this show would be very different. The focus of this show is primarily for the US. Now, it still applies to individuals in the UK having alias email addresses, using virtual phone numbers to prevent against SIM swap attacks. All of that still applies. What I'm talking about, though, is privacy from OSINT and people doxing you and that unexpected event that results in people wanting to find your location, which is so easily done in the United States through a simple Google search. Now, the line between practical privacy and the extreme end of privacy, I believe, is quite a blur. I'll give you an example. On the practical side, it may be just too much for someone to have their vehicle registered in an alias name. And more accurately, that would probably be an LLC. So you'd have a company registered as an LLC. Your car would be registered as a company vehicle. You need business insurance. But that vehicle should also be paid for in full. If you have an auto loan on that vehicle in your personal name, now things get very difficult. You can put your house in a living trust. And I am very fortunate that my vehicles are both fully paid for and they are both in a living trust. Again, if you have an auto loan on that, it does make things a bit more complicated. I haven't really talked about that too much yet in this podcast, but I will cover that. That's something I have done. I believe that falls into the scope of practical privacy. It's a very straightforward and practical technique to protect your title deed and who's living at your address. But when we talk about checking into hotels in alias names, we've got to remind ourselves of who we are protecting our privacy from and ultimately what our threat model is. Now, in my case, as of right now, I am not hiding from the government or law enforcement. Again, that could change overnight. I'm not sure how, but you've got to assume you're going to be suddenly thrust into the spotlight in a positive way or otherwise. Hopefully, in my case, it's because I win the lottery, but I'll cross that bridge when I get there. Now, the focus of this show, I really want to apply to anybody. Now, the goal is to make privacy something achievable for anybody. My grandma, the next door neighbour, Uncle Jack, whoever it may be, those people that aren't very technical, but maybe they want to dive into more of the technical aspects, but the privacy techniques I'm going to share should really apply to everybody. Now, I have a very technical background. I don't expect all my listeners to have the same depth of knowledge, but I will, from time to time, be diving into much more advanced and more technical topics. I don't think that necessarily falls into extreme privacy. For example, I've talked in the previous show about using Nextcloud and setting up your own server at home. And in future episodes, I'll dive into more detail around setting up pfSense, having an always-on VPN, multiple VLANs, different Wi-Fi SSIDs, depending on who's connecting and what you want to achieve. Now, all of that will involve some technical knowledge, but I will try and break it down and make it easy for anyone to apply, should they wish to pursue that. Now, I'll be honest, I also do this because it's my hobby. I enjoy this stuff. But also, I'm a field CISO, during the day at least. And in my role, I have to advise other chief information security officers on cybersecurity threats, ransomware, but also the threats that exist there outside of the technical. And sometimes it could be as simple as a SIM swap attack that exposes their organization's data. So if I don't put into practice what I'm preaching, what I'm talking about when I attend these events, then it doesn't make me a very good field CISO. Does that mean I'm invulnerable? Absolutely not. I just want to make it extremely difficult to be found and unlikely that I'll fall victim to a phishing, social engineering, SIM swap attack, or any of those attack vectors that are so common today. Also, any of the techniques that I talk about in these episodes, they are not one-time events. And something I've not really covered yet, but I will talk about, is data removal. So white pages, people search, all those online people search databases, the low-hanging fruit, I'll be honest, of where someone's going to go initially to find out where you live. In fact, I was contacted just 2 weeks ago by a representative at one of these data removal services sites. I won't mention the name. And they asked if they could be a sponsor of this show. But first off, I'm humbled. This is only episode 7. I'm still getting started with this podcast, but I've had a lot of attention, a lot of messages from listeners, and to be asked about sponsors this early on, I'm humbled. I think that's great. But I'm not going to have a sponsor of something I personally don't use and don't recommend. It's a lot of work, but Michael Bazell on Intel Techniques has a free data removal worksheet. I highly recommend people just go there, work through the list, and do it the hard way. Personally, I do this once a month. Sometimes I slip up, a few months goes by, but don't forget it. It's not a one-time activity. Every month, just have a morning, make your coffee, put some music on and think, okay, I'm going to see how far I get. Don't do it all day. Don't burn yourself out. Just do it bit at a time, piece by piece, and eventually you will cleanse your data from the internet. Okay, onto the topic of defensive OSINT. Now, initially, I didn't think this would be an OSINT show. And for those of you that are new to OSINT, it means open source intelligence. In its most simplest form, that's simply going to Google and typing someone's name. But OSINT can involve a lot of other things. Now, it's open source intelligence, so perhaps you are going to these people search sites that I just mentioned. You are looking at county records, which is public data, property tax data. All of that is considered OSINT. Now, from time to time, people I follow on social media may post an OSINT challenge. And there was one individual that I think she was doing this as a joke and thinking that no one would find the location. And it was a picture of the sky. Now, there was no geolocation data in the photograph, so there's no GPS coordinates. And I think she thought, well, this is just a funny way to end the week. And she posted it on Twitter. I'm not going to mention names, but the photo did have the top of a lamppost. OSINT doesn't have to be as complicated as finding metadata within the photograph and doing anything like that. I just simply looked at who this person was, and she ran her own business. The business address was an office somewhere in the United Kingdom. But if you look at the business director registration details, historically, that business used to be run from her home. So I went to Google Street View, typed in her home address, and I managed to match the design of the lamppost to the ones shown in Street View. So I knew that picture was taken outside her home. There was also, you could just about see a telephone line, a wire going across the street. And then by getting the angle right and seeing that wire in coordination with the top of the lamppost, I could see she took the picture at a bus stop, which was a few minutes around the corner. I sent her a direct message and she was quite shocked. Now, in my opinion, there's no advanced OSINT techniques there. It's just common sense. Something as simple as who is the person posting the picture can reveal a lot. So it's not the photograph, really, that gave her location away. It was the fact she owned a business, and that information is public. And this is in the UK. Now, I think it's important to understand OSINT in order to implement defence strategies to protect our own personal data. And this is where I would like your opinion. Do you think practical privacy and security should include OSINT? I personally think it does. I think even knowing the basics of people search sites, data breaches, and knowing how to obtain that information, even if it's as basic as searching for your email address on Have I Been Pwned or one of the other sites, I think that's important in order to establish a defensive OSINT strategy. But how far should I go down this rabbit hole? And it is indeed a rabbit hole. And coming up in Arlington, Virginia, is the SANS Open Source OSINT Summit. It's on Thursday, February the 29th, and it's a two-day event. They do a virtual option, but I will be there in person. So if you are there or planning to be there, let me know. Perhaps we can meet up, grab a coffee and nerd out about privacy, OSINT and cybersecurity. Now, I am thinking it will be great to meet some of you in person, but I may live to regret this. So we'll see. I'm going to use this as an experiment and see what happens. So if you're there, do let me know. I'm also involved with some organisations where OSINT techniques and skills are particularly useful, but I want to turn those skills into defensive OSINT. We live in an age where vast amounts of our personal and also corporate data are just freely accessible online. So I think the need for defensive OSINT has never been greater. Cybercriminals, malicious actors, identity thieves, they're looking to exploit this publicly available information for purposes such as identity theft, social engineering, corporate espionage, or even targeted attacks. Now, as privacy and security enthusiasts, I think defensive OSINT can really arm us as individuals to take a proactive stance in identifying and mitigating these vulnerabilities with our personal data. Now, defensive OSINT can be broken down into five areas or five steps. The first step is the information footprint assessment. And this is to understand the extent of our digital footprint. Now, on the worst case scenario, you have a Facebook page, your email address is in a huge number of breaches, you haven't done any compartmentalization, so you have one email address and you're sharing passwords across multiple services, yet you've got a lot of work to do if you're there. Now, tools such as search engines, data brokers, social media, these can all be used to assess the footprint. So as we go on in future episodes, I'd like to share more of how we find this information. And then step two is really around vulnerability identification. Once we have this footprint of our digital persona and this is understood, the next step is to identify potential vulnerabilities. So understanding how exposed information can be exploited. For example, birthdays. You may not put your date of birth online, but if you have a Facebook page and when it's your birthday each year, everyone is wishing you a happy birthday and those posts are public, well, it doesn't take me long to figure out your date of birth. So often I see people wishing everyone a happy 40th birthday or whatever it is. Well, that just exposes that individual to their date of birth, which unfortunately is one of the security questions used for social engineering to getting into a bank account or email or phone provider service. Okay, step three, the risk analysis and prioritization. You've got to remember that not all information exposures carry the same level of risk. Defensive OSINT involves analysing and identifying these vulnerabilities, but then prioritising them based on the potential impact. For example, if you have an old address showing up on a people search site, that may not be a bad thing. You don't live there any longer. It may not expose you. The priority here is your current home address, your SIM card phone number, which you shouldn't be using, but if you are, you want to get that removed. And then step four is mitigation. This is where you take steps to reduce the identified risks. Now, you want to remove sensitive information from public view. So I mentioned the Intel Techniques website. Michael has a great data removal guide on there, which is free. That's a good start. But there's also public records. Is your property tax public? Does that show your name? Perhaps you need to move your house into a living trust to remove that. These are all the mitigation strategies that, unfortunately, are the bulk of the work. And then step five, continuous monitoring and adaptation. As I've said before, this is not a one-time event. Unfortunately, the digital landscape is constantly evolving. New data brokers, new people search sites, new data breaches is happening all the time, even changes in data privacy laws. Now, a key component in defensive OSINT is this ongoing monitoring. I mentioned earlier, I do this once a month. Initially, you may want to do it weekly. You have to get aggressive with this. Your data will be everywhere. If you've not done this before, it's going to take a lot of work. But don't be disheartened. Our focus here is on the practical side of things. I'm not expecting you to take a week off work and work 9 hours a day removing your data. Just do this in small chunks. And if you look at step three, the prioritization piece, you're going to target the most critical data first. And then ultimately, your digital footprint has been removed online. Now, something else I've not really mentioned yet is disinformation. This can be very useful to throw people off track. People are going to be searching for you on Google. I'm not going to cover this in today's show, but give this some thought. What can you do? Perhaps an alias name with your home address. What can you do to get that exposed online? This is really like throwing dust in someone's face in a fight, but disinformation can be incredibly powerful. Now, defensive OSINT isn't always easy. I think while the benefits are incredibly clear, implementing this isn't free from challenges. Firstly, the sheer volume of public data can make this process, especially of monitoring and managing the digital footprint, absolutely overwhelming. As I've said before, this isn't an all or nothing approach. Don't look at this and think, oh, this is impossible. I just give up. I just want an easy life. Fine. I'll trade security for convenience. The dynamic nature of the internet means this is being exposed all the time, and even old information can resurface. The point I'm making here is it's not easy, but I don't advocate these one-stop shops for removing your data. If you're going to do it, no one's going to do it better than you. I see a bright future for defensive OSINT. This is something I would like to incorporate a lot more into this podcast. Especially with the advent of AI, who knows what the next data breach may look like? Can you imagine someone's personal data being exposed through ChatGPT because they trusted that information with ChatGPT and a future breach? I'm not saying this is going to happen, but it could. A future breach reveals through AI the most personal details of that individual. Now, I have an OSINT tool, a technique that I don't believe has been shared on other podcasts or widely known, and that is hunting apps. I was with a friend, this was a few years ago, and I was talking about privacy and OSINT and all the work I've put in to hide my home address from online data brokers. And he said, oh, is this your address? It took him seconds. I said, yes. What is that app you're using? Well, he does hunting. And there are hunting apps such as OnX Hunt, HuntStand, and many others that will use public information, and it's useful for hunters to find out if they're on someone else's property and who that person is in case they need to be contacted and they need to seek permission and enter their land. But what was quite shocking about this was the accuracy of the data. It not only had information from the title deed, but it was historic data as well. So if you have purchased your home in your real name and later move that to a living trust, you may just find that the hunting applications are using old data as well to show that to someone. And you can just search on the name. It shows you a map of all the houses. And over each house, this is with OnX Hunt, it shows you the names of the individuals living there. OnX Hunt is a paid service, but they offer a 7-day free trial. So you can set that up. Use a throwaway email address and an alias name, and you can check yourself to see if your information is listed. I'll make sure to include a link to the app in the show notes, but there are many others, and I've not even checked all of them out yet. But just be mindful that these are obtaining their details from public data, and if you've made recent changes, such as recently putting your house into a living trust, it may not be up to date, and they may not update that data for several months. So just be aware of that. Now, what do you do if you're signing up for a service online and they ask for your photo? Well, of course, if you're using an alias, then there are AI-generated images that you can use that are very convincing. In fact, it's been some time now that thispersondoesnotexist.com has existed. I've written a script, it's a Python script that goes to that site. You can enter the number of images you want with a switch, so -n 100 will give you 100 images, and it will also crop from the bottom to remove the watermark. I will link to that script in the show notes. It's on my GitHub page, but that's really useful if you want a bunch of photos just to pass off for your alias, or sock puppet as it's known. But what do you do with a gym that they're going to see you? They want to look at the picture that they have on file and match that it really is you walking in there. Well, I have a trick that I'd like to share with you. There's a website called facemorph.me. And what you can do is combine two images into one. So when you go to the website, on the left, you will have a picture of someone's face. But if you click on the little change mode, you can upload an image. So you select the image, you upload it, and you have your real photo on the left. Then on the right, it has Morph 2. If you click, you can upload another image in there, or you can click on the Browse Names icon, and it brings up a whole list of images, which I think they've taken from This Person Does Not Exist. So click one that's similar to you. And all I'm talking about is male or female, the right age. If you're wearing glasses, you can pick one of those. It really doesn't matter too much. You can pick any one. And if you click the morph button, what I like about this is there's a checkbox that says use slider. If you check that, you get a slider control. Far left is the original photograph. If you slide that to the right, it goes to the one you selected on the right-hand side. So if you use the slider and just change your original photo slightly, it kind of looks like you. To someone working in a gym, they're going to look and go, yeah, that's the right person. But when, and again, we're assuming a breach, when that data is exposed, that really isn't you. It doesn't look like you. That won't pass for identity theft. Now, I like to do this for a few things. There's a pool that I have to have membership at to take the kids. And they only need a photograph of me, so I give them one of these, and it works great. The people working at the pool, these are just checking that you have a photo. Now, obviously, if it looks nothing like me, it's going to raise suspicion. But what I love about this service is it's free, and you get an image which kind of looks like you. Now, the image itself is 512 by 512 pixels, so it's a small square image. But what you can also do is use a free tool called Upscale. Again, I'll put this link in the show notes. It runs on Windows and it will upscale the image. Now, the settings I have found that work best for photographs, especially headshots, are the use General Photo Re-Macri, and it upscales to 4 times. It does a very good job. So what you end up with is a very large, high-resolution photo that looks a bit like you, but is not you. And it works. Maybe you're joining a library, a local gym, but please don't use this for government ID. You're going to get in trouble for that. But for all these other online services that demand a picture of you, it actually works pretty well. Okay, moving on to location tracking. You know, something we talk about a lot, especially as privacy enthusiasts, is about hiding our location, especially not carrying devices that track our every move. You might not go as far as keeping your mobile phone in a Faraday bag. If you do, kudos to you. But you'll surely appreciate how important it is to disable location access for a whole number of applications. We need to make sure also that the camera isn't capturing location data that reveals where you live. Now, before I send anyone a picture, I'll give you an example. My water heater died recently and I had to send a picture of it to my local plumber. And by the way, I don't use large plumbing service companies such as plumbers or HVAC. I like to choose the one-man band, or perhaps it's a father and son business, because they're not going to be using online services for keeping customer records that's ultimately going to get leaked. I like the old school guy that turns up, gives me an estimate, and he writes it on a handwritten piece of paper, I just love those, and you're probably going to get a much better service as well. So recently, I had to send a photo of my water heater that has leaked all over the basement and show him a picture of the part that's leaking so he can do a quote. Now, obviously, I don't want any metadata in that picture. Location access is one thing that's obvious. So I use a tool on Windows called File Optimizer, and basically it strips all metadata from the picture. Another thing you can do if you use Signal Messenger is just upload the picture to Signal, and that does it for you. It strips all the metadata, including location and what device you have and so on. Now, there are certain apps that we do want to give location access to. Now, as you all know by now, I use GrapheneOS, and I've granted access to some apps for location data. Now, one of those apps is WeWow. No, it's not a Chinese social media or propaganda app. It's just a weather application. Now, I've only granted approximate location, but that's good enough for me to receive weather alerts and local forecasts. Now, hey, I'm British. We talk about the weather all the time, so what do you expect? But remember, my mantra is that we shouldn't be all or nothing when it comes down to privacy. I could deny location access to everything, but giving an approximate location to my weather app, which, by the way, I have found WeWow to be the best and most private weather app in the Aurora store, this allows me to receive critical weather alerts. Again, if you live at home with a family, their safety trumps everything. And recently, I had some quite significant weather alerts that we needed to monitor. Now, if you've listened to previous shows, you'll also know by now that I use my pseudo virtual phone numbers for absolutely everything. There's one exception. I've given my real SIM card number to my wife in the event of an emergency. Is there a risk that a rogue app on her phone harvests the contact information? Yeah, there is, a small one, but I have access to her device. She also uses my pseudo. That's where the number is stored, and I've made sure the device is as secure as possible. But as you know, there is no such thing as 100% secure, but safety trumps everything. Safety of human life always comes first. All right, so what about location access and other apps? DoorDash, here's one. I have not granted DoorDash location access, but it does have my real home address. Now, before you call the psychiatry department on me, let me explain. My DoorDash account is in an alias name, using a privacy.com virtual card. I think you're getting to know the pattern now. I use an alias for the email address. Now, my alias also has a dedicated virtual phone number. Now, I've created this fictitious person who lives at my house purely for disinformation purposes. I'd even go as far as saying that I'd love DoorDash to share that information, his information, and this is the alias I also use for Starbucks. I order Starbucks online. I go in and pick up a mobile order. You can have fun with the name on the app, but they don't have my real home address. Now, I'm not doing anything fraudulent here. I pay DoorDash. They deliver food. Everyone is happy. Now, if law enforcement were to obtain a subpoena and ask privacy.com to reveal my identity, they're going to hand it right over. But this isn't my threat model. My threat model is not hiding from law enforcement or the government. It's from data breaches that are happening every day as a result of ransomware attacks, or even data leaks caused by misconfiguration and human error. Now, I've already mentioned Uber, and I disable location access. And I only enable it when I'm away from the home and ready to order the Uber. And we've already talked about that. But just because your device can track you, if you're taking measures and only giving access to certain apps, sometimes it doesn't matter. And in the case of DoorDash and the Starbucks app, that's in an alias name. And I do want that data to leak out. It's disinformation. If that gets populated online, great. It doesn't have my real name in there. Remember, always assume a breach. This is the core principle of zero trust in the world of cybersecurity. But we in the privacy community have been applying this principle all along. Now, there are times when applications, Uber's one of them, won't accept a MySudo virtual number, and they demand a real phone number. Twitter, if you want to do Twitter verification, it needs a real SIM number. Now, the best workaround I have found for this is simply to buy a bunch of prepaid Mint Mobile SIM cards. You can pay the minimum. You don't need a lot of data, if any. Just pay the cheapest amount for a month. And you have a bunch of SIM cards that you can activate with real phone numbers. That's step one. I like to go a step further. I keep those numbers for 6 months. And the reason I do that, I want to age those accounts. I'm paying regularly. They're not treated as suspicious or anything like that. And then what I do, after 6 to 12 months, I port those in to MySudo. And at least for a period of time, those phone numbers are real SIM numbers. And even though you've ported them to MySudo, which is a virtual phone app, those phone numbers are fresh. They were on aged accounts. And you have phone numbers you can use for verification where typically a virtual phone number would not work. I do also like to keep 2 spare phones. I've got some old iPhones with SIM numbers. I have actually one in the UK, which is a prepaid, and one in the US. But you can have just one, which are prepaid in an alias name, paid for with a privacy.com card, and use those where they do need a real phone number. Now, those spare phones, I don't actually keep in a Faraday bag. I just power them off, but they are in my home. But again, they're in an alias name, so there's no association with my real name. Now, is there a risk that where you've verified that number, let's say it's Twitter, that data gets out, and then someone can find that number and they find out an alias name? There is. They could even find out my actual location with that number. Perhaps they pay someone off at the phone provider. But honestly, that is extremely unlikely. I only use those phone numbers for very specific things on the rare occasion I have to have a real SIM number. And honestly, once you've ported them into MySudo, that works most of the time. I think that just about wraps up today's show. Now remember, the new website is live, lockdown.media. I'm going to be sharing more technical articles. And in fact, right next to me is a pfSense router for the British, by Qotom. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. It's Qotom. I'm going to be sharing details very soon on that. It's a mini PC with an i5 processor, 8 gig of RAM, a whole bunch of network ports, and it is the perfect piece of hardware for running pfSense. Now that's going to be an in-depth guide. I'm going to go through the hardware, installing pfSense, and configuring it with all those wonderful things such as multiple VLANs, SSIDs for your Wi-Fi, and an always-on VPN. Now, I do not have any sponsors for this show yet. It's something I would consider, but it does cost money to run this show. Now, this is entirely optional. I don't expect anyone to donate or contribute, but if you do, I do have a Patreon account, and it's patreon.com/thelockdown. There's a link in the show notes and also on the website under the podcast tab. Again, that's entirely optional. Please do not feel obliged to donate or become a member. The idea is long term, I'm going to be interacting with everybody on Patreon. But again, this is not expected. And if you prefer to email me using a Proton mail address, then you can always do that. And if you do sign up for Patreon, use an alias name and a privacy.com card. Don't give them your real info. And as for the schedule of this podcast, I'll be honest, my intentions are to do this weekly, but I am on the road a lot. When I'm in my home studio, where I am now, it's easy for me to record the podcasts. Now, I am also a bit of an audio enthusiast, so my home studio is well equipped with different mics. It's acoustically treated. This is my space. So taking a mic on the road and doing the podcast in a hotel room gives me the shivers from an audio perspective, but it's something I may do if it means getting the podcast out more regularly. So for now, I just apologise in advance. There may not be as regularly as weekly, but I will certainly try my best. Anyway, thank you for listening as always, and see you next time. And my daughter has come in. She made cookies. They don't look like cookies.
They're not cookies.
They're just dusting cookies. Cookies are meant to be crumbly. Do you want to say hi to my listeners?
No, I do not. morning, madam. My name is George. I'm calling from the ITV1 hit television show Britain Has Very Much Talent.
Yes.
Did you watch the show on Saturday night?
Bits of it, yes.
Oh, what a spectacular event it was.
So what's this about then?
Well, basically, madam, as you know, Britain Has Very Much Talent, scours the nation to find the cream of the crop.
Yeah.
And we are happy to say that you have been selected at complete random to receive 2 complimentary free VIP tickets, which will not only allow you to watch the show live on Saturday night, but also allow you to come backstage and actually drink tea and a hot beverage with Anton Derek. Now, how does that tickle your fancy, madam?
Well, this Saturday?
Yes.
And what do I have to do for that, then?
Did you have a passport, madam?
Yes.
Would it be possible for you to, please, to photocopy that also?
What, give you my a copy of my passport?
Yes, and 3 bank statements?
3?
Yes, 3 would be good.
Oh, I'm not really very happy about doing something like that. No, I think that would be very foolish.
Why is that, madam? We have a number
of... Why do you want my passport in your hand? Don't you think it would be rather silly? Would you send your passport in the mail to somebody you've never met?
I tell you this, madam.
Yeah.
If a gentleman called me from ITV1 offering me a chance to live the dream of Britain Has Very Much Talent on a Saturday night, believe me, I would jump at the chance.
You would not
I would
send
jump at the
your
chance.
Passport through the mail. I think you're more intelligent.
I would jump at the chance of being able to sit there and stare at the back of Simon Cowell's and the coiffed hair. My God.